We appreciate you joining us on this beautiful Friday morning, and we just ask again that you not share any of the information that you're provided here today on our call, as this is a member benefit. I'd also like to thank Cornerstone Government Affairs for being a sponsor of the Iowa Healthcare Association's Friday calls from the State House. They have been a tremendous asset to our lobbying efforts down at the Capitol, and have really been effective this year in helping us with all of the things that we've been trying to achieve. So, and advocating for you all. So we appreciate them. I just wanted to kind of start out today and give you an update about where we're at in the legislative session. It feels like a session that has been going on for about 2 years. it has not. It's only been going on since the second week of January, but it has been a pretty, I would say, competitive and kind of a brutal legislative session compared to those that I've experienced at the Capitol in my career there over the last, 7 to 9 years. So, again, it was very, very competitive, but I want to run through some of the successes that we had, because I feel overall it was a very successful session. We weren't able to get everything that we wanted, but we dang near died trying, and I'm really happy with the results. Again, not everything we had hoped for, but we really feel that, taking into consideration the climate down there, again, a very conservative governor, very conservative legislature, and, again, a very, very competitive, environment for the state dollars that they do have. So I will just kind of start out going through. We'll begin with the SNF. The SNF sector. So I do want to mention that this is, kind of the tail end of the legislative session. And today is their last day that the legislature is paid per diem. So technically it's the last day, but they will be coming back next week. There actually wasn't any specific floor action in the House this week. They were very, very focused instead on those budget subcommittees. And the chairs have been negotiating all of those major budgets with their Senate counterparts. So, again, I think I mentioned last week that the total spending number for the budget this year is about $8.5 billion. So what they're doing is they're breaking those down into individual buckets. Health and Human Services is one of those buckets that our sector fits into with the Medicaid budget. So that serves all AL SNF and home health and home care. So, they were ironing out some of those bigger numbers this week. They have reached agreement on several of those, like I said, administrative and regulation, ag, transportation, and then finally the HHS, Health and Human Services budget, which impact you all. So we're very happy about that. The House Appropriations Committee, which is kind of the final step before it goes to the floor, they did agree upon that budget. The Senate actually yesterday did pass that bill on the floor. So again, it'll just be up to the House to talk about that next week, and then hopefully sign off. There'll be an agreement, and then that will go to the governor's desk. So in that budget, we have $15 million of state funding increase to our nursing homes. We had really, really advocated for a lot more, as you know. And I don't have to tell any of you, you've lived it. I know we know you face significant challenges with workforce, difficult or complex, residents, and then, of course, closures here in the recent months. So we were hoping to get more. We were in the House budget for $25 million. We started in the governor's budget at $15 million, and the Senate came in an agreement with the governor's office, making it very difficult for the House to achieve that negotiation of $25 million. With that said, I think that we have gotten kind of the cap on what between the governor's office and the Senate that they were willing to give us this year. And we have really, achieved something incredible again in this really, really competitive year and environment with a very tight budget. We were above, substance abuse and mental health. They totaled at a $13 million increase in state funding. With substance abuse and mental health rates, Medicaid rates. So, other than that, there were also with some family funding, and just some other smaller projects, that the legislature put some money into, but we were, above and beyond, received a greater appropriation than any of the other, you know, major Medicaid, I guess, budgets within the overall HHS budget. So we're very proud of that, and we will continue to advocate for more in the future and to kind of close that gap for the SNF shortfall. Another thing that I wanted to mention with regards to SNF relates to Medicaid reimbursement for basically an add-on methodology to provide services for Iowans who meet the nursing home level of care and are also required to register as sex offenders. So this is a difficult to place population in Iowa, and I think across the entire country, we've heard all kinds of you know, reports on that. So this is an add-on payment for facilities who are willing to provide care for those individuals, as I said, who meet the nursing home level of care and are required to register as offenders, sex offenders. A couple of other things that I wanted to mention, and I'm going to have Brandon kick in here for some of the technical details, since that's sort of his wheelhouse. But one of them,
Maria, one thing I'd want to add on the sex offender bill is that I think the program, when it's designed, will end up creating like the need to have a specialized unit or like a designated facility. I don't think that they want to have like one-offs in facilities. It sounded like it was going to be kind of more of a unit or an entire building is what they were shooting for anyways.
Yeah, you're exactly right. So thank you, Brandon, for the clarification. I also should mention that in this first year, what they're doing with this bill is requiring Iowa Medicaid to establish what that methodology will look like for those services. And so in this first year here, they will be looking into how that's going to go about, and we anticipate it'll roll out once that study and that methodology has been established. So another bill that I wanted to bring up with regards to SNF is related to the Medicaid program, and kind of the title is a third party recovery and taxation of the MCOs premiums. And I'm going to let Brandon get into this because, again, he's got the technical detail, and it does include a couple of provisions, one related to the certificate of need and the change of ownership process, as well as private pay. So I'll just say before I turn this portion over to Brandon for the details, we had an opportunity to work with the governor's office and DHHS on and DIA on what this would look like. So it was something that they were really pressing. And I think what we were able to do here with regards to the certificate of need process is really make it manageable. With the first draft that we received, we were not, we didn't necessarily agree with. So what we did is we provided feedback and were able to come up with a draft that we could live with. So I'll let Brandon get into the details now.
All right. Thanks, Maria. Yeah, this is a bill that kind of has a lot of different pieces in it, many of which were related to our nursing facility group. So I'll touch on a few of them here. One of them is a moratorium on certificate of need. And so it says basically beginning July 1, 2023, for a 12-month period, there will be no additions to facility beds or new constructions. The department would have the ability to extend that in 6-month increments, but it cannot extend beyond 3 years. That was one of the major pieces as they were talking about moratoriums that we wanted to ensure was in there, was that an end date was written in and it would end at some point sooner rather than later. I think the second piece of the CON moratorium that we were wanting to ensure happened, at least a project was being completed during that time. And as you likely know, the bed need formula has been in play for 40 years without update. And so an update to the bed need formula to get an actual depiction of what is needed in counties was a project we wanted to be as part of this, and that would be included within this scope of work. I think by the end of 24 is when that needs to be completed by. And so there'd be a little bit of a runway to help affect that. We would be included in that process as well. There are some exceptions it'd be like some specialized needs, which is loosely defined for a reason, because we didn't want to get into every single piece of that. But if you do have a specialized need, you could definitely present a case and it would be reviewed to be approved possibly. And then large, 85% occupancy of the facilities around you would also be another reason for you to be able to add beds possibly, or another reason to apply for adding beds. The other piece of this bill is the change of ownership process being updated. While many of the things that are listed out in this bill are more specific, the department actually had the ability to request a lot of this information anyways. They had some pretty broad discretion. It just may not have been flexed as much. And so this is a little bit more detailed information on what that should look like. There is the first part I'll go into is kind of about organizational structure and ownership structure. And, you know, in saying information about who owns 5% or greater controlling interest in the company or related parties of the applicant. They want a financial related piece is talking about projections for operational expenses and revenues, looking at realistic occupancy and realistic reimbursement rates to make sure that it's gonna process or cash flow properly for the new applicant as they come in. And then the third part that I want to talk about here is a regulatory history review, where it's looking at the history, if the applicant has operated facilities in another state, that they'd be able to have access or review and work with the provider to understand if there are any outstanding complaints or allegations or investigations, that there can be a discussion about that to make sure that high quality is coming in and being provided in Iowa. And then the last piece of the CHOW is a piece that would allow for the department to create an escrow or require the applicant to create an escrow account that would sustain financial operations for up to like 2 months. And so this is kind of as a result of some of the foreclosures or receiverships that have had to happen in the state where the funds to operate and cash flow have had to come from the CMP funds or from state dollars. And so just wanting to ensure that there's some protection there from the state's perspective. And then I think the last piece, well, maybe I have two more. One other piece is there's an MCO tax, MCO provider tax. What this does is it creates a premium tax for the MCOs that returns those tax dollars to the Department of Health and Human Services for use in the medical assistance program. Those dollars would then be able to be used for rates for providers who have not seen rate increases for some time. And I know, I mean, holistically, the injection of additional funds into a system that needs funds is a good thing. It should, you know, provide an opportunity to maybe access those funds or relieve some pressure on existing state funds, which, as Maria stated earlier, are highly competitive for us to be able to get access to for all of our members. And so this is kind of could act as somewhat of a safety valve or a relief valve for the crucial state dollars that do exist. And then the last piece is it has to do with the quality assurance assessment fee program and prohibiting the pass through of that provider tax increase to your private pay residents. And so basically what that says is that you cannot knowingly pass along a rate increase because of the QAF program. It does not say that you cannot provide private rate increases. It says that you cannot, when you're sending your notice or your rate increase letters, you cannot say, I am increasing your rate because of the quality assurance assessment fee increase. Obviously, you have many other taxes or many other costs wage increases or, you know, inflation or whatever the reason may be, that you've had added costs and need to increase your rates, the reason cannot be because of the quality assurance assessment fee program. And if it is, and if you do state that you are passing this along for the because of the quality assurance assessment fee, and it is told to the department or the state, there is a penalty now that exists. And this was something that the department was very, the department and the governor's office actually was very stern on, I suppose. There is a penalty now that you would be reimbursed at your base rate for a year if this is done. And so very serious, obviously. Does not happen often. We do not hear about it often. We have many other reasons for cost increases and for private pay rate increases. This just can't be one of them. Obviously, with the increase in the provider tax program, it's a significant penalty. It would be, you know, for some providers, about $70 a day. And for the waiver class providers, it would be about 43. So it's a lot of money on the line, obviously. And so just wanting to spend a little time here talking to you all, since that is now in there and likely to pass. We will obviously do messaging more about this in the future. But this law, this bill will eventually be signed into law. And just wanted to make sure that you all are aware of all the pieces there. So with that, Maria, I'll turn it back to you.
Okay.
Hey, Brandon, this is Diane. And which department are you talking about on ownership? Are you talking DIA or DHS?
Well, honestly, Diane, it's both. It's okay. Mostly DIAL. And then DHS does have some, a little bit of purview there, but it's mostly DIA.
Okay. And the one thing I want to thank all you guys for all your efforts. You know, I mean, I know it was brutal, and I know, you know, everybody's disappointed, you know, with the $15 million, but it wasn't because we didn't make a good effort and it had a good strategy. It's just, you know, I guess the thing that we have to think about as association is, you know, how do we get the governor and the Senate to, how many more facilities got to close before they wake up? So.
Thanks, Diane.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, thank you. I appreciate that. Yeah, I think, again, you know, in such a competitive environment, you're exactly right, Diane. We would have loved to have gotten more, and that's what we'll be working on here in the remainder of the year and moving forward, is just whatever we can do to kind of move the needle and get them on the same page as the House. So, Brandon, is there anything else that you'd like to add regarding the MCO premium tax bill?
Yes. Well, I guess maybe not. I think I did cover the premium tax and how it does return money. So I don't think so. I think that pretty much covers it. I guess I'll one minor thing that I'll say is it does include, I talked about the private pay pass-through money, QAF money not being able to pass through to private pay. The hospital has the same thing in there for language for them on some of their hospital directed payments too. So it's something that is a priority of ensuring that, obviously, in a state where we're trying to cut taxes, that there are not any purviewed or viewed tax increases not passed on to the residents of the state. So that's a priority for them.
Okay. Thank you, Brandon. The last thing I'm going to mention, well, I guess this is related to everybody. So it's a bill relating to staffing agencies and workers, as well as healthcare entities. So this is all of our sectors. But what this does is it's kind of a follow-up from the bill that we proposed last year. You know, anytime you propose new legislation, there are things that need to be cleaned up, and that's kind of what this bill does. And so DIA had a couple of small technical things that they wanted to clean up. Initially, that $500 registration fee from staffing agencies was going to the general fund. They requested that go back to DIA, which we're fine with, obviously. So they'd made a couple small technical changes. We also broadened the definition of nursing services to include a couple of more specific roles, including, you know, home health aide, med manager, things along those lines. CNA, there are several of those within the definition. And the definition also excludes a couple of rules, Aaron Pease and a couple of others. So if you're interested in seeing that bill, certainly give me a call. We'll be coming out with an end of session report. And I'm happy to share. If you want to contact me or Brandon or Brent, we can send you the specifics of what that definition includes regarding the rules. It also makes exceptions for agency contracts with foreign nurses and their ability to work in the United States. We did have quite an outpouring of concerns related to the ability to hire and then also on the behalf of the agencies to, place foreign nurses, and we didn't want this to harm our provider's ability to hire. So we did do a little bit when it comes to that, made a few small exceptions, but again, it makes the bill no less effective. That was our bill to die on. So when it comes to defense at the Capitol, there is always plenty to defend us from. One of the big ones, cameras in nursing facilities. We were kind of locked and loaded and ready to go on this. We had a small group put together to consult on what would be the best case scenario if someone were to propose language to put cameras in nursing facilities. I feel good with the legislation that we came out. The good news, however, is that we did not have to use it. So we were able to kind of squash that very early in the session and get it off our plate so I could breathe. And we didn't have to worry about that popping back up in another bill later on. So that is off the table for now. We do not anticipate, obviously, within the next, 3 or 4 days, that coming up again. A bill that we did not anticipate coming up was related to background checks on vendors. This is something that would have had a significant fiscal impact on you all. And it was proposed by a very high ranking legislator in the House. And we were able to kind of collaborate with some of the folks that we don't always agree with everything on. But it was interesting. We were able to come together and really sit down with that legislator and influence her to pull that bill. And we were successful in doing so. Another bill that we successfully killed that I think is relevant is the initially right out of the gates, there was a bill from, again, a very powerful senator that proposed CON for assisted living. So we jumped on that immediately and were able to have a conversation with him. And he understood why that wasn't reasonable. And we were able to kill that before it was even assigned to subcommittee. So those are a couple of things that we have been doing here over the past legislative session. I do want to mention specific to the elderly waiver. Last year, and Brandon, you can jump in if I fumble anything here, but last year, the waiver system received about $5.5 million in one-time funding from ARPA, those federal dollars. And in order to continue to maintain that rate, the legislature this year had to agree to find $5.5 million to put back into that so it was sustainable and that could continue on. So they did agree to do that. And we're very happy about that because otherwise, due to the fact that it was one-time funding last year, otherwise that money would have gone away. So we're happy that they obviously see this as a priority and they want to maintain that going forward. Otherwise, I would say that, related to, home health and assisted living, we have a ton of stuff going on when it comes to working with the departments and the executive branch on things that we think are really important to streamline processes. A couple of examples, I would say, mileage reimbursement for home health, approval to back up those Medicaid home health agency certifications to the date of services provided, reducing the number of hours required towards certification, and things along those lines. So we've had ongoing conversations with them. We feel good about those negotiations moving forward. It just takes, as anything in state government, as you all well know, it takes a long time to get those things achieved. So, but we will continue to have those discussions and certainly keep you guys posted on our progress there. And that was not an extensive list or, of what we're doing, but in your legislative and policy agenda, you can see more clearly the bulleted items that we're working on with the various departments. So Brandon, is there anything I'm missing?
I don't think so. I think, just as a clarifier, or some additional information on the HCBS increase, it was it ended up being like a 4.25% increase last year, which probably ended up being around $14 million that they used one-time monies on, maybe a little bit more. And so because of they were able to use the one-time monies because this is an enhanced FMAP that the state was receiving. And so because the public health emergency is ending, that enhanced FMAP will be begin to trickle away over the course of the next year. And so it looks like the plan is to continue to fund those private rates through the same process, or those HCBS rates through the same process until that enhanced FMAP runs out. And that is where this $5.5 million appropriation comes in to ensure that providers' rates stay stable. And so, you know, as it was identified that, you know, those one-time monies obviously are going away, the need to backfill those funds with recurring dollars was even more important, because obviously that's the last thing we want to have happen is for an eventual rate decrease to happen to our waiver providers, especially in a state that's trying to improve and enhance waiver services and home and community-based services throughout the state. And so just a little added, I guess, detail for that.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, that's a good point. And I also do want to mention, you know, one of the other things that we were doing this year was trying to secure a LUPA rate increase that was equivalent to the percentage increase received by those rural providers in 2022. So it was about $2.65 million in state share. So, you know, the issue we had, and I know I've said this several times, is that it was so competitive this year in a very, very tight budget. So we, you know, have had a million conversations with our lawmakers in both chambers. But I think, you know, when looking at those really, really snug budgets, the providers who received increases in the past, last year, et cetera, were facing a bigger challenge when it came to getting that funding again. So really it was kind of, I hate to say picking between kids, but I think that it really came down to some of those providers that had not received anything in the past. So that was the explanation that we were receiving down at the Capitol. Again, we intend to go after this, you know, every year until we get what we need. So we will, again, continue to advocate for that. But I wanted to make sure I mentioned that those were the reasons that we received for not getting a bump this year with regards to the LUPA rate. So I know that was a lot. So I think that's all I have. Brent or Brandon, is there anything that you want to add before we let everyone go or open it up for questions?
I don't have anything to add, Maria. You guys handled everything I wanted to make sure we did. Thank you.
I guess the only thing that I would probably add is it probably goes without saying, but, you know, as we wrap up legislative session, the Fridays from the State House call will probably be in its last couple weeks here. So just wanted to point that out because of the session being close to done.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Yeah, we can take some questions now. Feel free to unmute or put it in the chat if you have any questions or comments. We can definitely field those.
Brandon, while we're waiting to see if anybody has any final questions, I'll just make a comment. As Brandon alluded to, this will probably be the last Fridays from the State House call with a particular amount of import. We don't anticipate many changes from what you've heard today. I want to take a moment and thank everybody who's on the call. Most of you have been with us on this call throughout the legislative session, and essentially everybody on here has been a grassroots champion for the cause this year across all three sectors that we've been advocating for. And as we've said, this having been as rough and tumble a session as it has been, there is no doubt in my mind that we would not be anywhere close to where we are in terms of having secured funding, having secured historic tort reform, having secured really, really important policy changes to the way that the state handles its engagement with long-term care, we wouldn't be there, and we likely would be facing down more challenging outcomes on the defensive side of the ledger. So I want to thank everybody for doing that. I know you just have to take my word for it, but the engagement on the side of the membership makes every bit of difference that there is. And with the legislative session having reached its conclusion, we are going to be kicking off the campaign for the Iowa Health PAC. The Iowa Health PAC is a handshake with our grassroots efforts. It is those two things are what make us effective at the Capitol, representing one of the most challenging interest groups, which is what we are. That's not a bad word in the state. As I said many times before, long-term care is expensive. It is complicated and it is controversial. That makes it a very difficult issue to advocate for. And it is the strength of the Iowa Health PAC, which has allowed us to continue to be at the table, not on the menu, at the State House year after year. Given what we've just gone through, I know we all know that we have many challenges ahead of us when it comes to engaging with the Iowa legislature ahead. And so I implore everyone to consider your contribution to the Iowa Health PAC as soon as possible. Please contact me directly if you'd like to discuss it. But we're certainly opening up the donation portal now. You can go to the advocacy tab at iowahealthcare.org and donate now. It'll take you a couple of seconds. Asking everybody to sort of put the impact, you know, for example, for our nursing home members, what is the impact of a total of $164 million of new Medicaid funding mean for your business, and what does it mean for your career? Because these are personal dollars. Consider that as you consider supporting this campaign. So I wanted to take an opportunity mostly to thank everybody, but also to say you're going to be hearing from us soon on the Iowa Health PAC. And if you'd like to help us out really early, the folks that are going to be making decisions about our sector are going to be elected and reelected in November. And so we have a short window. We need to start the campaign now, and appreciate your consideration for that. Brandon, back to you for any final questions.